يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. It has been nearly a month, but I'm delighted to say I am joined today by our Middle East North Africa consultant. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how's it going?
I'm fine. A little bit tired, James, but always a pleasure to be sitting in this small studio and discussing the Middle East North Africa with you.
Likewise. Well, Harry has been on his travels to the region all over the place. There's plenty to talk about. In fact, there's so much to talk about that today we are going to literally delve in and around the houses talking about Lebanon, Syria. We'll talk about Turkey, Iraq, and so much more. I don't know where to start. So I think I will start with the neighbours of Syria. Clearly, Harry, the status quo remains, if not actually getting worse. And we're seeing violence in Syria as well, Sunni-Shia tension. Where do you want to start with the fallout?
Well, I think it would be good of us if very quickly we remind our listeners, James, that the situation in Syria in the third year of the uprisings is still the same. You're right, there is a standoff. There is fighting taking place. The balance is moving all the time, shifting from one side to the other. One minute the rebels have the upper hand. The next minute it's the regular army and President Bashar Assad's supporters who actually regain some territory. So it's in a state of flux at the moment, but that state of flux means that neither side is winning, nor is either side losing. And in fact, with that stalemate, which is costing so many lives, that we are roughly now talking of 100,000 deaths, including, of course, all the refugees, horrendous numbers of refugees in neighboring countries. The most affected neighboring countries, of course, being Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. The fact that this war, for a want of a better word, has actually seeped into Lebanon. And we're already seeing, I dread to say, the visible symptoms of the tensions from Syria being exported into the region. And of course, Lebanon being vulnerable is already feeling some of the shocks of the fighting taking place in Syria. So still a difficult moment, still uncertainty as where we are heading, but I still remain stubborn in my belief that these are pains that we have to go through, and that eventually, and I say eventually with a heavy heart because it is costing a lot of lives, and any human life from any side to me is one painful loss. Eventually, I think we will begin to see something shaping up, but it's too early at the moment to even hazard a guess as to what kind of shape that would take in the months ahead.
Now, you and I have often talked about Lebanon specifically, and you've mentioned that phrase, when Syria sneezes, Lebanon catches a cold.
Absolutely.
Well, it really has caught one this time, and that sort of simmering tension that we've seen sort of exploding in Sidon, you know, 16
Absolutely.
Lives lost. Now, Hezbollah's involvement is controversial, isn't it?
Hezbollah's involvement is controversial. As your listeners know, I've got a very soft spot for Lebanon. I'm not Lebanese, but I love Lebanon. It's a wonderful country, a sense of entrepreneurship, a touch of steel that makes all the Lebanese, irrespective of their confession, every time they have a calamity, a disaster, they stand up again and move forward. It's that spirit which I find extremely encouraging in the country. And yes, this small country, this young country, has had many problems since independence, and certainly recently you mentioned Sidon. Yes, Sidon is where clashes have taken place between Sunni fighters, the Lebanese army, and elements of Hezbollah, which is the Shia militia, the most powerful in Lebanon, actually. But there have also been other incidents in the north, in Tripoli. There have been some in the Bekaa Valley, and the Hermon Mountains. So a lot of tension, a lot of fighting, and of course the fear is twofold at the moment regarding Lebanon, but also regarding the whole region, which is why I think we've got a wake-up call recently that something has to be done, because we cannot maintain an aloofness to this crisis in Syria. The U.S. administration and its president have been extremely hands-off and aloof. We in the U.K. and in France have been much more hands-on. We've realized the dangers of letting things drift. And therefore, the immediate danger is that some of the fighting would go into Lebanon, and given the confessional makeup in Lebanon, it would flare and lead the country into another calamity. But the worst situation, the more ominous option, would be to see that that scar, that gulf between Sunni Islam and Shi'i Islam resurface. And of course, you might know, James, and so might our listeners, that at the heart of that divide between Sunni Islam and Shi'i Islam is basically a difference, an ideological difference, that goes back to the times of the Prophet Muhammad and who succeeds him. The Sunni think that it is the caliphs and the caliphates. The Shi'i think it's actually the son-in-law of the Prophet himself, Ali, who should be the successor. So this is a major difference between the two. And there have always been simmering tensions under the surface. Those are coming up. And now, in my travels, as you mentioned in your intro, I felt for the first time in the most vociferous and in the most vocal way a sense of, I don't want to call it hatred, it's too big a word, but very strong discomfort of Sunnis and Shi'is against each other. And if this were to continue, then the whole region could actually turn into a Muslim-Muslim civil war, and the Christians who are indigenous to the region could actually be victims of this latest flare-up or worse conflagration.
Now, civil wars in the region, Lebanon especially, Syria, I mean, they don't last 6 months, 7 months. They tend to be 10 years, 15 years.
Indeed.
Are we on the verge of a 15-year, let's say, civil war?
I hope not, although some analysts, and I always say I'm not a prophet, and I will also add, no analyst can actually tell you today what's going to happen tomorrow. But largely, we can see that this is something that is not going to be resolved in a day or two. It is something that's going to take time. And this is why, as I said, there is a new galvanizing spirit within those who are called the friends of Syria in order not to forsake the rebels. The simple mathematics of this is the following, James. The Syrian regime and President Bashar al-Assad are supported at the moment very vocally, very publicly, very strongly by Iran, by the Hezbollah forces, and of course indirectly but very strongly by Russia. On the other hand, you have the rebels who are supposedly supported by the friends of Syria, which largely means some Arab countries, the Gulf countries, as well as the West. But the idea until now has been that there is a parity between the two camps, so that both realize that they are not going to score a victory, and so both are pretty much forced to go and sit around the negotiating table and discuss a future for Syria. Now, that future, in my opinion, is threefold. Getting rid of Bashar al-Assad, if it were to happen, is not the end of the crisis in Syria. It's the end of the first battle. I think there are two other battles that will have to be fought out. One is between Sunnis and Shi'is in Syria, and the third one would be on the nature of governance in Syria post-Assad. So in a sense, at the moment, I think we're standing very much on the edge of a cliff, and it is my hope, and it is the hope of very many well-meaning men and women, Christian and Muslim alike, that I came across the MENA region, who are also hopeful that things will begin to calm down, because the majority of the people, of course, clearly don't want this fight. However, there are some issues that have basically grounded them into their own positions, and that is what we're seeing play out in the whole region.
Now, we've said we're not doing in-depth analysis, of course,
absolutely,
in this podcast. So I think perhaps it's a good time to mention that our listeners and viewers, of course, can check out epectarsis.net, your website, where later today, I believe, there will be an article published on specifically on Lebanon and its involvement. Or
indeed,
should it be involved, should it not be involved?
Indeed.
So for that level of analysis, I might recommend you check out www.epectarsis.net. So, Harry, let's look at other neighbours at this point. Turkey, now, not really going to wind this into Syria beyond obviously the refugee situation and so forth, but the Beşiktaş region of Istanbul and the sort of plans for a park, wasn't it, the parkland and what to do with it. That resulted in, rather a swift and staggering uprising against the government at that point. And I just wanted your view on that, bearing in mind, obviously, that was a few weeks back.
Certainly. I mean, one of the things that you pinpointed to, and it is very important, is the refugee issue, James, because it's a human issue, it's a humanitarian issue, and it is one that the churches are very intimately involved with, or should be, because that is part of our ministry, that's part of our diaconia as churches. Having said that, yes, the refugee situation and the political situation in Syria is affecting very seriously neighboring countries. We spoke about Lebanon. You're right, the article fleshes it out much more analytically. There is also Jordan, which is suffering the economic strains and the political threats of the situation. There is Iraq, where only a couple of days ago we had yet another set of car bomb explosions which killed 30-odd people. I mean, we become so immune and inured to this that 30 deaths on a day is almost like a blip on our TV screens, and then we move on. It doesn't make us focus our minds because it's happening almost every day. And of course, in Turkey, there have been the violences which started in Gezi Park, where the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan wanted to build a mall. And I think that we should look at this a little bit more dispassionately. Now, as an Armenian, some of our listeners might think that I will automatically adopt an anti-Turkey stance because of the history between Armenians and Turks. I will not. I commend Turkey for where it is today. And I think Turkey has come in leaps and bounds since the Second World War. The new government, the AKP government of Erdogan with President Gül, have tried, yes, they've Islamicized a bit society, that's true, but they've also achieved a lot of economic potential, a lot of success in the country as well. And I think that it's not only a question of an Arab Spring impacting on Turkey. It's more a question, if we see it there, we see it in other countries. We see it in Brazil. I mean, look what's happened in Brazil. Brazil is part of BRICS. Mm-hmm. BRICS is a movement which is a successor of what I would call the third world or the developing world. It's Brazil. It's got China in it. It's got Russia in it. And it's got India in it. And I say BRIC or BRICS because if we say BRICS, we add South Africa to it. I think that inevitably Turkey is part of BRICS, even though it's not in the acronym. However, what we're seeing happen is a sense of citizens across the world have suddenly discovered that they can make a difference. And wherever there are issues, grievances, they go out on the streets to demonstrate. Now, the question is, first of all, what are those grievances? And secondly, how do you handle those grievances? One of the biggest mistakes that Prime Minister Erdogan did, which paradoxically is something he criticized very strongly the Syrian regime for doing, is that he went down with such a hard fist on those demonstrators, tear gas canisters, the whole riot, police trying to contain them, that immediately there was a popular reaction which spread from Istanbul all the way to other parts of Turkey. How do you handle this? Now, the Brazilians have learned a thing or two. The president of Brazil is trying to negotiate with the activists. But the question is, the activists themselves don't know what they want. You talk about somebody in power and you talk about opposition. It happens in the MENA region and it happens across the world. The president or the government is doing something we don't like. So we demonstrate. But we don't know what we do like. And that is the hub of the problem. When you come and tell me, let's sit and negotiate, I have a position. If you come and say, I don't like your position, period, I stop here, that's not going to take us far, is it? But if you tell me these are my counter proposals, then in a spirit of reconciliation, we could sit down and talk about them. This is what's happening in Turkey. I think Turkey is suffering from what some Turkish analysts are calling Sultan Erdogan megalomania, because he has extended himself too much. He has become a little bit too arrogant. This is the third term of his party in power. It inevitably gets to you and isolates you from the reality around you. So I hope this is a wake-up call for Turkey, and the European Union have already sent a couple of warnings saying, be careful, this is not the way to go. We'll wait and see, but it's also part and parcel of the ructions, the fault lines, the seismic afterthoughts, as it were, of what is happening within the Arab Spring arena, if I want to call it that.
Do you know what? You've taken us out of the Mediterranean, across the Atlantic to Brazil. Now, I'm going to try and take us back across the Atlantic, if you don't mind, to the shores of Northern Ireland. Now, this might seem like me flitting about a bit, but we have had a G8 meeting. We had probably more press coverage and more talk before that meeting, Putin meeting Cameron,
yes,
discussions over the arming of regime versus arming of rebels. You and I spoke in our previous podcast about who you're actually arming when you are arming the rebels, so-called rebels, we'll call them. I want to know why we haven't heard so much off the back of the G8. Is that, I mean, Syria was supposed to dominate, and yet what really has come out of the international community there?
Well, there was a lot of build-up to the G8 summit, and I followed the G8 summit as a consultant quite closely. And Syria was one of the two key issues there. The other one was an economic issue across Europe. Remember, you're talking about the eighth most powerful economic countries coming together. Now, the build-up to it was to try, what our prime minister tried to do is to build ahead of steam in order to push his agenda, which to a large extent I would agree with, as far as Syria goes. However, the reason we haven't heard much about the G8 summit post it's taking place in Ireland is because, very simply, that they didn't achieve much of what they had hoped to achieve. And the reason is twofold. One reason, and many, many people have written about that, there are reams of articles on this, is the fact that the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, was basically the spoiler in that meeting. All other seven countries wanted to act on Syria, wanted to listen to the French and British positions and do something, because they were very worried that following the change in the forces in the parity in Syria, things were going the wrong way and something had to be done. Russia stuck to its gun because I think Russia is being very stubborn. The reason it's being very stubborn is it's got the whiff of a new post-Cold War impact on the region. It lost out in Bosnia. It lost out in Libya. It lost out in Egypt. It doesn't want to lose out in Syria. So it's sticking to its guns and saying, I want to do this. But Russians are very realistic and pragmatic people. When they realize that we're coming to the nub of the matter, they would relent. The question is, would their relenting at a late stage be useful or not, given that actually they're not the key players? The key players, in my opinion, are Iran. And they're the ones with the election of a new president, Rouhani, who is being called a reformist. Well, I don't think he's that much of a reformist, James, because, yes, he's a friend of Ayatollah Khatami. He's somebody who is perhaps better at delivering, better at reaching out to others than his predecessor, Ahmadinejad, who thought that his mission in life was to uncover the hidden imam, the hidden Mahdi. Whereas this guy says, yes, I'm willing to talk with you. He was part of the nuclear negotiations with the P5+1. What I think happened is that we have somebody who is very much part of the establishment. Otherwise, incidentally, he wouldn't have been allowed to run for president. He ran for president. He was allowed to run for president. He got a resounding first round majority. So the question is, how would he act? Does he have the ability and the levers to make much of a change in foreign policy? I don't think so, because the person who does that is the top man, and the top man is Ayatollah Khamenei, not President Rouhani. However, in politics, subtle changes and nuances matter, and let us hope that this would be at least a confidence-building measure for us to do something. But you're absolutely right. G8 started with very, very high hopes, and it ended up a little bit on a whimper. However, that whimper still translated in the West trying to get its act together, being roused from its political slumber. And what we've seen happen since then, we've seen it with Qatar, for instance. There's been a succession where the Emir of Qatar has actually moved now from Emir Hamad to Emir Tamim, who is his son. All this is indicating, which incidentally is a remarkable succession, James. In the Arab world, I have yet to see a monarch or an emir or somebody who would willingly say, I cede my place to my son. It is still a family affair, but at least new blood is being injected into this extremely rich and rather politically influential little country. So in a sense, I think all this is happening, and maybe, we keep saying maybe because hope lies at the very heart of our faith as Christians, but also at the very heart of my work as a political analyst, that we might actually move forward. I look around me, and you can tell me, Harry, you're daydreaming. Look around you. Everything is collapsing. I could tell you, yes, maybe, but from chaos might come some order at some stage.
You see, I suppose the cynic in me is saying, well, maybe people had that hope of al-Assad 20 years ago.
That's also very relevant. And I think that the way I read it is it cannot continue the way it does. The way I read it is we should contain what's happening in Syria, not to allow it to infect neighboring countries, although it is inevitable. And if it does, to try and limit the impact on neighboring countries. The British ambassador, our ambassador in Lebanon, constantly uses one word which he loves, stability. And that's what I call for, stability for Lebanon, stability for the region, and some sort of a solution, whether you call it Geneva 2, Geneva 3, Geneva 4, it doesn't really matter, in order to move forward. And that moving forward, I'm still convinced, cannot happen without the removal and the departure of President Assad and his immediate retinue, but without the dismantling of the political system and institutions, because we do not want to create a black hole like we did in Iraq and then suffer the consequences later.
Now, we have covered an awful lot of ground, I have to say. So I'm going to just pause to give a couple of quick shouts to our Twitter accounts. Mm-hmm. Yours, Harry. You can follow Dr. Harry Hagopian, our consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, by checking out at Harry Hagopian on Twitter. And if you want to follow us, the church, you can do so as well, of course. And that's at Catholic EW. Harry, it's fast approaching that summing up time. But mm-hmm. I think you've got something quite interesting to talk to us about in terms of Arabic pop culture, have you not?
Yes, I do. But let me give three very quick shots at the end, just food for thought for our patient listeners who put up with my ramblings every now and then, James. The first is, we had a very interesting discussion, Bishop Declan Lang and I, yesterday with the Palestinian ambassador in the UK, Bishop Declan being the chair of international relations at the Catholic Bishops' Conference. And we had a very good review of what is happening in Israel and Palestine. And this is essential to our mandate as a conference here because of the Holy Land coordination, where every year there is a pilgrimage that goes to the Holy Land, usually Israel, Palestine, and Jordan, in solidarity with the Arab Christians of the Holy Land, but also in order to learn about what is happening on the ground. So meeting we had yesterday, one of many ambassadorial meetings we're having across London with MENA ambassadors, was a very good indicator of how things are moving or not moving at this stage. And therefore, a thank you to Bishop Declan from me for his patience, and to the ambassador who gave us a wonderful review of the situation. The second pointer I would make is that Egypt also is going through very, very seismic changes. I think President Morsi is in a very weak situation. There is a movement called Tamarrud. Tamarrud means rebellion. And they are garnering millions and millions, and I literally mean millions and millions of signatures, asking him to resign the presidency so that there are new elections, because a lot of people in Egypt are very unhappy with the performance of the president and the agenda that his party, the Muslim Brotherhood, is bringing into the country. The Copts can say a lot about it, but so can Muslim secular people who are very, very unhappy with the president. The question is, this will come to a head between now and the 30th of June, in other words, in a couple of days' time, 3 days' time, and that is very interesting. I don't think the president is on his way out, but I think it's another call for him to be careful. And finally, let's end on a high note, James. Arab Idol is a Arab-wide competition every year, which is televised from Lebanon, where every Arab country suggests its performers to compete on who becomes the winner of the Voice of the Arab World for that particular year. If you want, it's a bit like Voice UK that we had in this country with Tom Jones, with Will I Am, with Jesse, where they basically vote. All the Arab people in all the Arab world, can you imagine how many countries there are, vote for their favorite man or woman to win. And lo and behold, a wonderful booster for the depressed Palestinian psyche this year was that the winner was Mohammed Assaf. Mohammed Assaf is a refugee boy from Gaza. Wonderful voice. I mean, there are lots of YouTubes. Just Google Mohammed Assaf and you will get his voice. Absolutely brilliant voice. Young man with a wonderful smile who won this year against very fierce competition from two others, a man and a woman. A young boy who actually made his mark. So congratulations to Assaf. Mabruk, as we say in Arabic, to Palestine and all Palestinians who were up in delight. And can you blame them? All they feel is defeat. And finally, they had a victory. And let's hope that this will be something of an omen for things to move in the future. Again, that's me trying to be hopeful, albeit maybe not so convincingly.
Now, our listeners and viewers probably haven't had the great pleasure of hearing Dr. Harry Hagopian have a little sing-song when he's in a more relaxed mood. But I have, and I have to say, I think for next year's Arab Idol, there's some serious competition there, Harry.
Well, there you go. But you know what? I think I'll stick to my piano playing.
You do that. You do that. Well, thank you ever so much for sticking with us for this, I have to say, extended Middle East analysis. And you can see us as well, of course, which is fantastic. The Twitter feeds we've mentioned, at Catholic EW for the Church, at Harry Hagopian for Dr. Harry Hagopian. Just remains for me to say, keep checking out catholicnews.org.uk, the home of Middle East analysis, and we'll be back with another podcast or vodcast very soon.
And don't lose hope in the meantime.
Don't lose hope in the meantime. Couldn't say it any better than that. Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much.
Pleasure, James.